Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Never mind the bollocks. Here's Jim and Patrick.
You said bollocks. Patrick, we have talked in the past about some other major anniversaries of bands and debut albums and things like that. And what I find kind of fascinating as we do this again on this episode of Rockin' the Suburbs, I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
That out of the way. Is this, in terms of 40th anniversaries, being that, 40 years ago was a pretty important time in music in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, that this anniversary we're going to talk about today comes actually after we've done 40th anniversaries on the Ramones and the Clash.
Yes.
Yet, I think in people's minds, in the sort of revised, revisionist sort of timeline of people's minds, they might think this one was first.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the Sex Pistols.
Never mind the bollocks. Right.
To a lot of people, this is like in their mind sort of the original punk band. Really not the case, but I think because of how sort of explosive they were and how they basically kind of set the tone for a lot of punk to come, and just sort of kind of how controversial they were and all of that, that I think they become sort of like, 1A in terms of like punk history, right? In some ways.
I think you're right, Jim. I think culturally they made a far bigger impact than the Ramones and the Clash and, Minor Threat, any other punk band, first wave or second wave that you could probably think of, right? Because, like you said, of their image, how just completely shocking they were at the time and how much their style from the artwork they created for their releases and, the vocalist they had and the front man and their whole fashion.
The safety pin.
Yeah. And it can be argued where that came from. Some say it was Malcolm McLaren saw it, Richard Hell doing it and took it back, but it doesn't matter where it came from. They're the ones that crystallized it. And because of that, they just totally changed music and culture in Britain and America.
The spiky hair, the dyeing your hair certain colors, things like that. That was, if the Sex Pistols didn't necessarily originate it, maybe they stole little bits and pieces from other places, they sort of perfected it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And it became, I think, the fashion and the style and the look and the image, all of that became what, at least for a long time, people thought of when you said punk rock.
Yeah. Exactly.
And
the political and socioeconomic conditions in Britain, London specifically, were just ripe at the time for something like this to take hold. And it did. They just came along and stepped right into the void and it all exploded in their wake.
So we're talking about this, of course. I mentioned it's the 40th anniversary of the release of Never Mind the Bollocks. Here's the Sex Pistols. Their one official studio album, which came out on October 28th. 1977. They had released singles before this album came out, but this is the one album, and this is for, I think, a lot of music fans. It's almost like an important document in terms of like rock and roll, right?
Exactly.
This thing that I'm holding right here.
Yeah. I think, from the orange and green on that cover to the songs, as you mentioned, the singles are four singles they released prior to this record. They're all included on this album. But you and I, we were talking about this before we hit the record button. We were just a little bit born a little too late to kind of catch that. I think we were probably around the age of 9 or 10.
Yes.
Something like that when this came out. And we learned about it not that long after. But for us, or for me anyway, it was the same thing. It was kind of the essential punk document that it's where you started.
Yeah. I remember, of course, hearing of the Sex Pistols when I was a kid.
Yeah.
If for no other reason than they were called the Sex Pistols. And right there, you just, you know, you can't help but, you know, prick up your ears. What is this all about? And again, it was sort of this notorious image that they had of just, you know, of sort of purposely, you know, existing to shock people, which, you know, even when you're a kid, you, I don't know, there was some buzz around that or something that just seemed, it would make its way to you, even if you, you know, weren't necessarily that well versed on, you know, underground music or anything like that. But it was just sort of like, you would hear about this, the Sex Pistols, punk rock. It seemed actually really kind of like frightening at the time, you know.
It did.
To a way that maybe you had to be a little bit older to kind of like embrace it and get it. So it was really not until sometime in the 80s that I actually like sat down and listened to this and really started to explore it. And it's an amazing record. We'll get to that in a little bit. But I think going back to the late 70s and, you know, a lot of what we're talking about in terms of like the shock value, the politics of it, the image, I think punk rock over the last 40 years as a term has really gotten very watered down. It's become a mainstream thing, even to the point where I think a lot of rock bands today, you know, call themselves punk rock or pop punk or whatever it might be. You just hear that term thrown around all the time. And I think what gets lost on that is that back then when it happened, it was a sort of a term that had some real definition to it, and it frightened a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
It really, you know, even people who grew up with, you know, the British Invasion or rock music, who, you know, consider themselves maybe sort of like that first wave of being kids during rock and roll, they didn't really want anything to do with this.
Mm-mm.
You know, it just seemed too far out there, too scary at the time. I can remember being a kid and, you know, when I mentioned like the spiky hair, the image of that, like you kind of had this image of like, man, if you went to a punk rock show, like in some dingy basement and people there were, you know, had that kind of look, like, were you going to make it out of that place? Right.
No,
it was really different, I think, than what you have, what people see as punk rock today. Right.
Yeah. I think that's well said. And it did seem genuinely terrifying, at the time. And think about the way, you know, the person that was drafted in to play bass for the band after the original bass player was kicked out, the way he went out, you know, and so there was a genuine threat of violence and destruction. I remember being a kid, I don't know, you know, like I said, 10, 11 years old, and must have been in 1978. I know it was now. And just somewhere in the house I was living in, someone had the evening news on, and there was a report about the Sex Pistols, you know, touring the United States for the first time, you know, showed them a clip of somewhere in Texas and people like flying through the air at what was supposed to be a, you know, I thought of a rock concert where you sat down in like an arena, you know, didn't seem to have violence like that attached to
it. That's right. What the Sex Pistols did was basically, whether it was for shock value, for image, for publicity, or was legit, and I think it's actually a combination of those things, but they tried to really like challenge every norm.
Yeah. And I think it's important to note too that while originally Malcolm McLaren, you know, a Svengali of some sort, there were rock and roll managers that were important in history prior to him, right? There was Brian Epstein with the Beatles, and there was Colonel Tom Parker with Elvis, and, you know, there were others, but he really created what he thought would be a genuine youth rebellion product, and it grew out of his control very quickly because he didn't count on the fact that the singer was going to end up figuring him out immediately and then begin to take control of where things were going. And though McLaren still claimed credit for all that, I don't think he deserves as much sometimes as he gets. I think, you know, John Lydon, Johnny Rotten should probably get a little more credit for taking the band where it ended up going and genuinely, you know, taking them into territory that they probably wouldn't have gotten to if he hadn't been so smart and you know, so genuinely talented.
The Sex Pistols only had this one proper studio album.
Yeah.
I think the impact on music beyond just, you know, sort of fashion and culture, but music itself is also just enormous.
Yeah.
If you were going to list sort of like most influential artists, hang on, car going by. You know, there's obviously a lot of different ones you could list, but I don't know that like there'd be anybody else who would be as influential with basically 12 songs, right? You know, pound for pound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could talk about a band like the Velvet Underground being a huge, hugely influential band in terms of, you know, relatively small output.
Yeah.
But it was still four albums, right? Not one.
Right. And the same thing with the Stooges. You know, they kind of did it with three or two and a half, depending on how you look at it.
Right. Yeah.
Well said. And I think for the music that you and I came to adore the most, probably this may be the most influential record of the bands we came to, love. Even a band like R.E.M. owes a large debt to the Sex Pistols.
I think so. Yeah. Again, I can't imagine anybody else having as much impact with one album. It's enormous in that regard. Right. Okay.
Yep.
All right, let's take a quick little break, and then we'll talk about actually what's actually on the
record. I'm excited about that.
This is a little break. We haven't done this in a while where we're actually promoting ourselves, and we need to do that because we need to get things back on track here a little bit.
We do. Yeah. You know, we've been busy. There's been a lot happening.
So if you like the show,
which I think you
probably
you
do, if you haven't done this already, this would really be great. Hit the little subscribe button on iTunes. They call it Apple Podcasts now, whatever you call it.
It's purple on your phone.
Subscribe button, and then the show always shows up in your feed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great way for you to get it, but it also helps us out too because it sort of elevates the exposure that other people see it within iTunes and blah, 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 all that. You don't really care about that. It just comes to you. It helps us out. That's all you need to know. And then if you can, also, you know, tell a friend and get them to subscribe too.
And I think almost any device on which you listen to your podcast, Jim, whether that's something you hold in your hand or put in your pocket or do on your desk, it's got to subscribe and it's got to review.
Mm-hmm.
And you just use those two functions. That's all we're asking.
Please do that. It's Rockin' the Suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
Hit subscribe. Boom. Done. Okay, Patrick.
Yes, Jim.
Never mind the Bullocks. Here's the Sex Pistols.
Yep.
Talk to me about the music. What jumps out at you there?
Holidays in the Sun and Bodies, and a lot of the songs on here, they feel raw, they feel immediate. I mean, I was listening to it on the way over to your house today and with the windows in my car down, and it still cut right through, and it felt, you know, as fresh as anything. And let me ask you this, Jim, to get into this a little bit deeper. I would also say not only is it one of the most influential single debut albums, right, that you can think of, but you could also make an argument that it's a great compilation album because four of these songs plus one B-side had already been released. And, you know, that makes up half of the album.
So their first single was Anarchy in the UK,
yeah.
right? And that came out several months before this album.
November 1976, almost a full year. Mm-hmm.
And in England in particular, singles were still a big thing at that point in time.
Yeah.
So they put that out, and then a little while later, they put out God Save the Queen, which sort of aligned with the Silver Jubilee.
Yeah, that's right.
Or Queen Elizabeth
May 1977, yeah.
Right, and that's famous because they did some promotional stunt on the Thames.
Yeah,
right,
on a boat. Right? Yeah, exactly.
Sort of crashed the party,
yeah,
something like that.
Exactly.
It's kind of amazing.
But the B-side of that was No Feeling, which appears on this
right,
record.
Right, yeah. Right. But let's start there with those two songs. Yeah. I mean, what do you hear when you hear it now? What do you hear in, like, Anarchy in the UK and God Save the Queen?
Well, what I mostly hear nowadays is Steve Jones's guitar and how incredibly powerful it is. And it's a derivative, I think, of probably what you heard on some Stooges records. And I know that was an influence, but you also hear a little bit of The Modern Lovers and maybe a little bit of the Velvet Underground, but what you hear more than anything is just a directness and a raw drive, you know, that mm-hmm. that just it sounds like a clarion call to a different world. And then when you get this guy who comes on top of it and starts singing, you know, it opens your mind up.
I mean, I've heard you talk before about how much you like certain bands and the way their records sound,
yeah.
and how they just kind of cut through everything else. They come out of the speakers so strong that it almost, you know, cuts through any other ambient noise that might be around. This is one of those records.
Very important. And, you know, it's interesting to note as well that, sure, you know, this was a raw band that was setting a new template, but we have to remember that at the time, the way you did that was not through an independent label, but through a major label. So they did have some resources to go in the studio. I mean, they started off on EMI Records. They got thrown off that label.
Yep.
A&M paid for some of these recordings, right? And then finally Virgin came in and, you know, paid for enough to finish them. But I think, crucially, there was two people that helped them record these songs that were there the whole time, right? So we had Chris Thomas
yep.
as a producer, and then kind of as an engineer, you know,
Bill Price
is sort of a guidance person, yeah, who obviously worked with The Clash later as well. But they kind of got a consistency of sound. And, you know, I think for the most part on the core of the album, Steve Jones is also playing bass because mm-hmm. Sid Vicious really wasn't, you know, able to do that. They knew what they were driving at. And whether it was released on a single or put together on this album, it all sounded pretty much of a piece.
It sounds completely of a piece.
Yeah.
And the other thing, I think, going back and listening to it, and I've listened to this album so many times,
sure.
you know, I could pretty much recite this thing
yeah.
by heart. But, you know, another thing that's just really, really impressive about this, too, is for 12 songs on the U.S. edition, I know Submission was added at some point,
yeah.
so I don't know if there were 11 in UK or...
I think it was 11 in UK, and then
anyway.
I think the US one had 12 originally, at least the one I had did.
But a dozen songs. Is there a bad song on this record? Filler, really.
No, I think there are a couple that probably sound a little dated, but maybe, I don't know, maybe New York sounds a little dated to me, but... Yeah. Other than that, no, they're not bad songs in any way at all, and they completely hold up. I mean, I listened to it with utter joy from start to finish on the way out here and was surprised it was over so fast. You know, and it's a smart record in many ways, too. John Lydon was showing his intelligence and his understanding of the socio-political circumstances he was in and where his band fit in and what was going to shock people. I think he also understood that really, really well.
Well, yes. And there are certainly are some very provocative songs on here, yeah, like Bodies, for example. You know, that they did a song at the end called EMI, which is a big kiss-off song.
It really
right?
is. It's great.
And it and the ending of it is just fantastic. Yeah. You know, this, and then, of course, you know, Anarchy in the UK.
Yep.
I mean, who at the time was writing songs like that? And then God Save the Queen. You know, we over here in the States, you know, we can't quite relate to it exactly, but we understand that it's about, you know, sort of like sticking it to,
totally,
you know, to the classes, to the people in charge.
Yeah, you know? Which, you know, pretty much wasn't done. And think about a song like Holidays in the Sun, where it opens up with the sound of like marching boots, right?
Yes.
Which just totally shakes you up. But then also think about, Jim, that that song came out in October of 77. So it was basically the lead up to the album release, right? So it was a single, but it was pretty much recorded for the record. But in the time since the first single came out in November, bands had started like all over the place in England. And there was a band called The Jam, and they had a song called In the City. And if you listen to the guitar riff of In the City and the guitar riff of The Holidays in the Sun, they're pretty much exactly the same. Already in their wake, before their album even came out, the Sex Pistols had spawned a whole set of bands, you know, in their wake.
I want to touch on that in just a second. The other one, I think, too, as a kid, you just can't help but love is No Feelings.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, every kid can sort of relate to that song, right?
Exactly right. It's a fun one to sing really loud to upset the parents.
That's right.
Yeah.
So talk really briefly about this famous concert.
Well, Manchester was a really famous one. If you know the movie 24-Hour Party People, you know, maybe there was, I don't know how many people were there, you know, like 12 people or 20, 22 people. But everyone that was there turned out to be the, you know, like Marquis Smith was in the audience. The Buzzcocks were there.
Right.
You know, apparently a young Morrissey was there as well. You know, all these famous people all sort of exploded from that evening. And, you know, it, as the movie dictates, that, you know, became a seminal moment. But there were several like that, too, that the Sex Pistols played where, you know, people showed up and those people ended up becoming, you know, whether it was Susie and the Banshees, who was part of a group that followed, you know, the Bromley contingent that followed the Sex Pistols around, or, you know, with somebody like Joe Strummer, who was in a band, a pub rock band at the time, and decided, man, this music I'm playing now is pretty antiquated, you know, and I need to drop this and pick up at the next opportunity something else I get. But, you know, and then Buzzcocks went on to become the first band to self-release a kind of a record, all inspired by the Sex Pistols.
Yeah, supposedly members of Joy Division.
Joy Division,
also
yes,
in the,
right,
in the gig.
Exactly.
It's called The Gig That Changed the World.
Yeah. There you go.
So think about that.
Amazing.
It it really is. Yeah. And you know, you mentioned how just incredibly influential. I mean, certainly that wave of British acts, you know, this was sort of like the defining moment in the way that, say, like the Beatles on Ed Sullivan were for so many bands
absolutely.
Before. But then I think it even though if you go by sort of the timeline, if you know, punk rock really started in the Bowery of New York. The Sex Pistols influence, I think, then came back across to the United States. And I think, again, I think the second wave of U.S. punk bands, if I'm thinking of, like, say, the SST bands, things like that, I think they're more related to the Sex Pistols style of punk than they are the New York style.
Would agree. Yeah, and I think that's what they embraced more than anything, right? It's sort of the danger and the speed and you know, everything around that. And in the sound, too. You heard that more direct, raw English sound in those kind of records. And that resonated with me, you know, more clearly than a lot of stuff.
The hardcore stuff, yeah. And I think the DC hardcore scene and things
exactly.
like that. It was definitely a feeling of, like, we are not trying to be anything like, you know, the rock bands that came before this. Absolutely. Whereas I think the New York bands were still sort of rooted a little bit in the classic rock. They were just trying to maybe get it back to, you know, an older, more basic sound that they really yeah. liked, but it wasn't really kind of like upsetting the norms the way the Sex Pistols tried to do. Yeah.
And I think your point sort of about the Beatles and Ed Sullivan is really well made, because I think pretty much everybody who has an abiding and ongoing interest in rock and roll remembers the first time they heard a Sex Pistols song, whether that was on the radio or a single or at a friend's house or this album, you know, being played somewhere. You remember that.
You can't help it. It's just that kind of a record. Mm-hmm. And over time in the U.S., even though it never charted at the time or sold many copies at that time the way it did in the UK. I mean, it truly was revolutionary in the UK. Absolutely. And they had like, these were like top 10 singles and things like that.
The album came in at number one, even though it was banned in many record stores and couldn't be displayed because there was a court case because bollocks was, you know, some sort of obscenity or something like that.
I mean, honestly, I can't even imagine what that was like. I mean, the closest thing we have in the US would have been Nirvana's Nevermind, but it's not the same
thing. And the closest thing we would have to that kind of censorship really, you know, was like a warning label on a record or like Two Live Crew getting banned. You know, I mean, we just didn't, it didn't have the impact, you know, that this must have had in such a geographically smaller and, you know, socially smaller and more intense atmosphere.
But what I was going to say is that even though it didn't have the immediate impact in the U.S., sales-wise, it did eventually go gold and then platinum. So many, many years later, maybe, it, you know, as many as maybe 20 years, 15 years, something like that, it did eventually achieve major sales in the U.S. So people, to me, this is maybe even a greater testament to this sort of like the revolution, but the idea that people over time have really appreciated this record, not just for what it symbolized, but really just for how good it is and how many times you can listen to it. That's well just said. You know, how good really, you know, how strong the songs are on here.
Yeah. And I think you see that in the way, in the wake of Nevermind the Bollocks, all these different pieces of Sex Pistols product that came out, you know, everybody that ever signed a contract or had some sort of piece of the band was trying to squeeze it out, whether it was Great Rock and Roll Swindle or, you know, all these different records that you would see that purported to be a Sex Pistols record. But there was really only one, you know, there really was just this one that was the real, true, genuine product.
If this was just for shock value, if it was just a stunt, you know, if it was just a fad or a trend, it would not have lasted like this.
No, you're right.
Yeah. And so there is something much more important in the record itself. We have gone way long. You can tell I'm really excited about this.
Well, this one merits it. You know, it's been 40 years, Jim. It's a really important record. Maybe this podcast, will, like the Sex Pistols, Nevermind the Bollocks, will go down as influential. Maybe people will start podcasts after hearing this one.
I could go on more and more, but but we can't do that.
We cannot. The sun is setting here in the
suburbs. At
some
point, maybe we'll talk more about PIL, because what I think is just really impressive there is, you know, this album comes out October 1977. The band ends up breaking up like
February 78, San Francisco, something like that.
Yeah, that's right. So you're talking only a matter of months after this came out. And then by the following fall, November of that year, you know, John Lydon has another band and puts out a single.
Incredible.
So he has really tremendous talent that I don't think people appreciated at the time or would have thought at the time. And he just comes right back out and says, you know, forget all that stuff. Now I'm going and I'm putting this out. And then here's a guy who is essentially, you know, the father of UK punk. And then he becomes sort of a pioneer in what's been called post-punk.
That's right.
You know, he sort of goes off in a different direction and guides people that way. And really amazing. So we'll talk about that another time.
Absolutely.
All right. We've gone really long. We're not going to go through all the closing stuff. You guys know that already. We'll just say that this is Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lennon.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you guys again later. Yeah.
him.
They first meet him. He's wearing a homemade sort of T-shirt that says, "I hate Pink Floyd." Yeah, right? I mean, there you go. That's what they're rebelling against, right?